with most content, there's usually one thing that the author of that content wants you to know. The question that I ask myself is like, what is that one thing? And is that thing valuable?
So it took 3 years to go from 0 to 1,000, 5 years to go from 1,000 to 20,000, and then only 3 years to go from 20 to 40,000. Tell me like what the growth story is.
Well, first of all, growing these letters is really hard.
True.
It was all organic growth, which I actually think is the best kind of growth sometimes, because I think when people find you on their own accord, they stay with a different intent in mind.
Is there anything that's like such, like so controversial enough where like you shouldn't have a take?
So...
Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. My name is Francis Zierer, and today we're speaking with Suraj Kapoor, the creator of Pointer, a 10-year-old, 40,000 subscriber newsletter curating articles for engineering leaders. He started it 10 years ago when he was working at a VC firm that asked him to curate things for tech leaders at their portfolio companies to lead. He took it with him 3 years later when he left because nobody else had really the ability to run it precisely like him. He developed this really specific taste that people, that his readers really missed. So he kept writing it. And then in 2022, he left his last full-time job and really began monetizing it. And now he's been living off this newsletter since then. So really good story. He has a lot to say about curation, about building internal tooling for newsletters. Yeah, great conversation. I hope you enjoy. So I think that aggregation newsletters are, it's a popular style because it seems easy on the surface. But because it's so easy, I think it requires a finesse, a level of taste, a knowledge of what to include, what not to include. There's this finesse to it that I think makes it much more difficult than it seems on the surface. Tell me your approach to aggregation. You've been doing this for a decade.
I mean, I started out just reading a lot. it sounds maybe obvious, maybe silly, but...
That's how you tune taste.
Well, that's exactly right. Like, you spend a lot of time training your brain thinking about what it is that you are trying to share with your audience.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when Pointer was small, I really spent a huge amount of time sifting through and reading a lot of content and debating and discussing with myself what I think is the thing that our audience would want to read. I think that I really spent a lot of time just doing that. And obviously, as you kind of move forward and you get more and more reps in, then that becomes easier. But there was a lot of work done in the very beginning, just reading a lot. And also just talking to our audience and understanding what they were struggling with. I think because I have a very specific audience, or I think I do, like... You know, learning what they are working on and what they are struggling with actually helps a lot in figuring out where you want to share content. I think, you know, if you have a newsletter that's a little wider in terms of its the content that it covers, then maybe that becomes harder. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that was a big part of it.
I think we have to bring up the origin story, which is that this wasn't like something you went out and started. You're like, I want to curate, you know, news items for engineers. But you were working at a VC,
right?
And the VCs, you know, the engineers across the portfolio companies, you wanted to specifically give them information that would help them, which is like a really good forcing function on like, here's this very specific audience. I don't know how many portfolio companies there were and how many engineers there were across them, but let's say it's like a few hundred. It's like, here's a few hundred people and we need to like make them better to get a return on our investment. So that's like, it's rare that there's such a clear and specific audience to like actually go talk to and like, how will I help this person be better at their job?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's probably an atypical way of starting a business, but we had, I think at that time it was like 100 companies, maybe 150. Mm-hmm. Each one of them had a technical co-founder. A lot of the technical co-founders were pretty young, so they were good programmers, but they didn't have experience necessarily with managing teams. And my job was to help them. My job was to like, you know, what is the they would come to us with basic questions about management and leadership, or they would have some problem that they had and they needed help solving it. So initially, you know, the way that I tried to solve that problem is by pairing them with other CTOs that had gone and been there and done it. But that's not very scalable. It's not very, you know, it's hard to do. It's hard to scale as you have a company of 150 or a portfolio of 150 CTOs. So we just started, like, I just started sharing articles. And the cool thing is in 2014 is that there wasn't a huge amount of content. There was some, obviously, but it's not what it is now.
The thought leadership industrial complex was in its
infancy. It was not what it is now, for sure. And what's cool is that the content that was present at that time was just like blog posts by CTOs who wanted to write for themselves, who were thinking for themselves. I mean, that still exists today, and, you know, no shade on content right now, but it was definitely more focused in that space where, you know, there were like three or four writers, and I can name who they are now, who I was like, this is just really high quality stuff. Because they were writing for themselves, they had clearly had experience, they clearly knew what they were doing, and I would just share those articles. And it was, you know, that is the thing that started this business. It was just like sharing like 3, 4, 5 articles by these folks that I was like, okay, this is great. This is exactly what you need, or is something that you will probably want to consider as you build your business. So, and that just some kind of formalized itself into a newsletter, because then the CTOs shared it. They shared it with their peers, they shared it with their friends, they shared it with their teammates, etc.
Yeah. So, I mean, back then, much easier. There's a very specific group of people you're speaking to. Like, yeah, as you're saying, there's maybe, you know, 3 or 4 like must read writers, probably a few others that you're folding in from time to time. Now, 10 years later, you are no longer at that firm. This is your business now. There's around 40,000 people in the audience, and there's a glut. There's just so much writing out there. How has that changed it? Like, I don't know, maybe there's like steps in the growth of, yeah, of from like, you know, 0 to 40,000 and like not a lot of writing to a ton of writing. But yeah, what's different now?
I mean, there's a lot more content to go through, but I also think it's become easier for me. I think as I've honed my skills, I also think with most content, there's usually one thing that the author of that content wants you to know. And so when I look at a piece of content, the question that I ask myself is like, what is that one thing? And is that thing valuable to the people that I know? So, you know, I speed read. So I do go through a lot of content, but I'm just able to go through a lot quicker. I think there's also just ways of going through content where you can, you know, sort of just like read the introduction or just kind of get a sense of like, okay, this is the direction of this article. Like, is this generally interesting? Mm-hmm. You know, is this sophisticated? Is this unique? Is this sharing something novel? Is this opinionated? What is the intention of the article? Is it trying to sell something or is it trying to share something? Like, I think those are two very critical differences. And so like having that kind of a light framework, when I look at an article helps me immensely in just distilling it and being like, okay, yes, I can shortlist this for my newsletter, or this doesn't feel right.
Okay, so the newsletter structure itself is basically at the top, there's an ad, if there is one, which there usually is. Now we'll get into the monetization in a little bit. There's a handful of article links. Maybe it's like 5 to 8. There's a block quote in the middle of those. With each article, there is a TLDR. Either it's a little summary that you've written or it is a longer quote, but just a short paragraph, really. And then there is the most popular link from the previous issue, which I think is a really nice feature. And then the notable links, which they seem to mostly be like links to GitHub pages. Mm-hmm. I'm not an engineer. I don't really understand this. And then a feedback poll and the end. And this structure has held true pretty much the entire time. But the TLDRs, it's probably quite simple. But I am curious more how you write these and like which one, like why this one, you know, justifies an actual little write-up from you versus a quote. Like, what's the thinking there?
I mean, I think this goes back to like every article tends to have one thing that the author wants to say. Mm-hmm. So if I can find that one thing in a quote and use their voice to say it, And that to me is my approach.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, I try and stay as neutral as possible. You know, the way that I see it is I'm like, this is not my take on what they are saying. This is their take that I'm sharing with you. I think that's somewhat subtle, but to me, it's quite important. And then if it's hard to find, a quote, then I'll try and summarize it the best way that I can.
Yeah. Tell me more about this neutrality. Like, is it, is there anything that's like such, like so controversial enough where like you shouldn't have a take? Cause it doesn't seem like it's politics to me.
Yeah. It's not me. It's not. I think it's more just stylistic.
Mm-hmm.
When I conceptualized Pointer, I mean, I was working for a VC firm.
Yeah.
And this is a newsletter being published by a VC.
And you were doing it for 3 years at this VC.
I was doing it for 3 years. And so what I wanted to do was I wanted to divorce it just in terms of its aesthetics, in terms of its brand from the VC firm and make it feel very neutral, make it feel very like, you know, this is its own entity. It has its own voice, but there's no face to it. There's no name to it. There's no person that's trying to kind of like be the face of it, if that makes sense. And I think that's just kind of carried on in terms of its style and its branding. I think it's also just if people, it's like who I am. Like I'm not big on like social media. I don't post a lot of stuff myself. So I just think like having that neutrality, to me is important. It just feels good. Mm-hmm. And I think stylistically, I actually think it helps. Like, this is a stupid example. I read The Economist, and one of the things I think The Economist does is that it doesn't actually have the author of the content.
The byline,
yeah. Like, it's by The Economist, and it's kind of like, this is the entity that is publishing it. This is their point of view. And my point of view is the curation, right? These are the articles that I'm endorsing. And the reason why is really the author's reason why, the author of the article's reason why, but I am just kind of like the person that's putting it together, or Pointer is the entity that's putting it together.
Yeah.
So I try and divorce myself as much from it as possible as who I am.
It's really rare, I think, in the creator economy era to have something like this, because it's like obviously one of the most reliable ways to grow a presence, to grow a newsletter, is to have organic social and pushing something there and having, you know, the opinion that people come for, the person with that opinion. Do you think it would be possible, like if you had to start it today and you wanted to build something similar, and maybe you aren't building it at a company, you're building it fully independently, do you think you'd be able to build this up in this neutral, like, you know, way where people might not even know your name, even if they read it every day?
I mean, I'm sure it's possible. I just don't think I would enjoy it as much. I don't think it would be me. I don't think it would be authentic, put it that way. Mm-hmm. I think I enjoy it more as like building this brand. Mm-hmm. It feels more of a brand that way. And it's also why I don't really identify, we talked about this a little bit before, I don't really identify myself as a creator. I think, to your point, like creators, and maybe this is just a bias, but they have names and faces, and I don't have that with Pointer.
Yeah. One more thing on the curation. I think, regarding AI, this is something I know people are using AI for. Like, or there was a, I forget what it is. What was that Google thing where it's like you could put in, give me the news of the day of this, and it would like generate a podcast? Do you remember what that was called? It's not Notebook LLM. It might have been, but regardless, my point is, I think this is one thing people have talked a lot about using AI for, is like, oh, I don't have to read the news anymore. I can just say, hey, ChatGPT, I want to know what happened in my favorite sport today, and like in tech regarding, you know, like AI, whatever it is, right? Give me the summary of this in 10 minutes, and then I'm not going to go read anything. I think obviously there's an art to curation, and that's this finesse that we've been talking about. I don't know. Does that threaten you at all, though?
I've thought about that a lot. I mean, in principle, yes, because it's probably, maybe it's an easier way to get information. Maybe that information is more personalized, which I imagine it would be, because an LLM would know what you're thinking, working on, etc., those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
I do think, though, that human curation is gonna be important and maybe more important as we go through this transition. I think having a relationship with what other people thinking is a very human thing. I think also understanding what's happening in the industry is a very important thing. And, you know, like, part of building this brand is building trust with people and hoping that they trust me in giving them a unbiased opinion as to where this industry is heading. And I don't know if they'll be able to get that with or they'll feel that they can get that with an LLM. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but yes, I mean, could it be a threat? Probably. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what about your relationship with your audience? You told me before that you do, I mean, some of these people are just your friends from, regardless of the newsletter. Some of these people, I don't know if you have a correspondence with them, but we were just talking about how this, it's not the Siraj newsletter. It's not about you. You're not, your name isn't really in it. But you do have a relationship with your audience and with specific people in your audience to some extent. Tell me about this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we launched it, it was with the portfolio companies of the VC. Mm-hmm. So it was a small but really high caliber audience. They really enjoyed the newsletter, so I always stayed in touch with them about it. Obviously, that was 2014. It was a long time ago. So some of them still stay on. I'm sure others have unsubscribed. And
some of these startups have exited. Some of them shut down.
some of those people are probably billionaires now while I'm still writing a newsletter. So cool. But what is really nice, and I think this is the thing that I never expected happening, but I think it's probably been, I would say, one of the most like joyful things of this business is mm-hmm. you start to actually connect with people in the business. Mm-hmm. And I've made friends because of the newsletter. People have reached out to me who have wanted to sponsor. Maybe it wasn't the right time, but I'm like, oh, what you're building is really cool. It's really interesting. So I would have a conversation with them. And I love to do that. I love to like just chat with people who are in the space because it also gives me the opportunity to learn what they are working on, what they are thinking, what challenges they have, mm-hmm. which educates me and educates my process for building the newsletter. And also I do like to connect with people. Mm-hmm. So just having that, and I do encourage that in the newsletter. Like I think I haven't published it recently, but I will say like, you know, I love to know what you're working on, click reply, and you know, I would usually get like two or three replies. I'm working on this side project. I'm building this business, or I have this problem at work, et cetera, et cetera. And that to me is super interesting. Like it's great. And, it's just allowed me to connect with people. I've on two occasions now, I've actually like ended up investing in like doing like angel investments in companies that have sponsored us.
Just put the sponsorship money right back into the
sponsorship money. Yeah. No, they weren't at the times of the sponsorship, but they were just connections that I made. And I was like, oh, mm-hmm. what you're building is really cool. Like this makes a lot of sense. And I would grab coffee with them and we would build a relationship and, you know, they would be in a position where they were building their company and I was able to make an investment. But really, I think the overriding thing is I was like, okay, that's cool. Like I made a friend. And it's someone that's like-minded because I love to build companies and so do they. Mm-hmm. And I was not expecting that from this.
Hey, if you're enjoying this conversation, consider subscribing to the podcast. We release a new episode every Tuesday. All right, back to the show. I want to talk about the Pointer origin story some more, though. So the basic summary, from what I understand, is you started it. You're at this VC. You're there for 3 years. You leave. And, you know, it's part of your job that you leave there. They don't really know what to do with it, which makes sense. It was your taste and your approach that you'd tuned over 3 years. And so they give it to you. You have it. You keep doing it. I don't know if you take any breaks, but then you try to monetize it in 2019, experiment a little bit. You have a full-time job. So you're not really pressed. And then in 2022, you do start monetizing it. And now, 10 years later, it's your full-time job. So mm-hmm. that's the basic summary for the listener. Tell me about like the point when you leave the VC and then from then to you then taking it. Because I've talked to people who like they sold their newsletter, it was acquired, whatever. But this is the first time I've talked to somebody who like started this at a company and then took it with them.
Yeah. So, I mean, when I was at the VC, I was doing it twice a week. And I just really enjoyed it. Like it was almost felt like an escape to me, like just this like, hey, I can like, you know, spend 3, 5, 7 hours in this week just reading stuff that I'm interested in.
The dream.
Yeah. And, you know, just sending this out. And I knew people liked it. So when I left, it was just biting to me that I couldn't do it. Because it was mine. I mean, no one was helping with it. It was, you know. And so when I left in 2018, it was just tough. Like, it wasn't being sent out. I was getting emails to my personal email being like, hey, like, all my, like, LinkedIn.
Where the hell messages. Is it?
Yeah, being like, hey, what's happened? Like, why aren't you sending this? We love this. And so, you know, I basically just had a conversation with them, I think probably like a year later, maybe like 9 months later, being like, look, like, you guys aren't doing it. I love doing it. Just give it to me.
You'd found better product market fit than the average startup.
Yeah. Yeah, basically. And I mean, that was super cool. They're like, yeah, just take it. Just keep on doing it. I think that they very much respected like the builder culture. They saw mm-hmm. like the spirit in which it was built.
Well, and it was still benefiting their portfolio companies.
Yeah. I mean, it was, yeah.
Not to
was,
be like cynical about helping. It.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, yeah. And then I kept on doing it, but it was always like this thing on the side. Like, I had a full-time job, up until 2022. So it was about just finding the time to do it and kind of fitting it into my schedule. But it just kind of, for me, it was like, I have this really cheesy quote that I read once, but I kind of live by it, which is, do what gives you energy. Mm. The founder of a company said that, but it's always stuck in my brain, and it's the thing that gave me energy. So I wanted it back, and I kept on doing it. And then, yeah, now it's a proper business.
Mm-hmm. So you started properly monetizing it in 2022.
Yeah.
You don't need to tell me, like, you know, specific revenue numbers, et cetera. I don't expect that. But like, when I trust that you basically live on this. This is your full income, right? You have another business, but this is how you make your living. How long from when you started monetizing in 2022 did it take to reach a level of income from this that, you know, was what you were comfortable living on?
So when I left my, I was working at Nike. That was the last full-time job I mm-hmm. had as an entrepreneur in residence. And when I left then, I gave myself 6 months to experiment with Pointer. Because at that point, I think it had reached about 20,000 people, 20,000 subscribers. So it wasn't insignificant. It wasn't, you know, some of the newsletters are today. But mm-hmm. I knew the engagement was great. And I know people enjoyed it. So I said to myself, okay, I'm going to give myself 6 months. I have the runway, financial runway to do this. What kind of revenue can I make with it? And what kind of a business can this be? And so the funny thing is, and I think actually one, like, in hindsight, one of my regrets was I just assumed it would always be a side business. Hmm. And it would never really make my, like, make a living for me the way that it has now. And I mean, you know, not a billionaire, but it's, you know, it does well. And I think that I wasn't as bullish about it as I should have been. Because, yeah, within, I mean, less than 6 months, it was letting me pay rent. And I was definitely under the gun at that point because I just signed a lease in LA, which is super expensive. And I was like, this has to work. Otherwise, I have to find a full-time job, which I didn't want to do. So I
great almost incentive.
Like, yeah, I almost reverse engineered like the finances of the newsletter, the sponsorship money to like be like, okay, like how can I survive off of this thing in the mm-hmm. next year, comfortably.
And what so, did you said? Wait, you said a second ago that it was a regret of yours that you framed this always to yourself as a side business. What's the regret there?
I mean, now the way that I see it is I'm a lot more bullish about it financially. Mm. I think as a business, I think that I can build this into a much bigger business than I anticipated.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, and I'm starting to see the path to that as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how you do sponsorships. So at the time you started monetizing this, it was 20K. Now it is 40K in the audience. The audience, I mean, on the website, there's the sponsorship page. You have, let me see what you have done, that 50% managed teams of the audience, 10 years average professional experience, 90% US based. And then you've got logos from, you know, Google, all the big tech companies. It's very obvious that this is a high value newsletter to sponsor. It's B2B and it's managers, it's people with high spending power in their personal lives and as people who hold budgets at work. Very clear why any tech company would want to sponsor this, right? Tell me about standing up that function though, and like how you, the businesses you first approached, who your first sponsor was, minimum commitments you were asking for. I'm curious what it was at the beginning and then maybe how it's matured. Yeah.
So ironically, I remember the first company that ever reached out to me was, this is kind of random, but it was Burrow, the sofa company.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh my God, someone wants to pay me for this. I was so excited. And so I tried to like make that work and it didn't work. And then what I realized very quickly afterwards when I stood up sponsorship properly, mm-hmm. was that really there's a very specific type of sponsor, which is developer tools, the SaaS companies, but 90% of the SaaS companies are developer tools that want to sell to engineering leaders or want to get their attention. It's obviously a huge business just in terms of like product category. You know, a lot of those names aren't consumer names, but they're names that engineers would know. And they all raise a lot of money. They all raise a lot of money because they have to hire a lot of engineers to build them. Maybe that's going to change with AI, but they also need to spend a lot to acquire customers. Like that is a big reason by which they raise. Mm-hmm. Acquisition for them is expensive. So if you're a B2C company and you want to acquire a customer, maybe it's $3, $5, $10. It's very different if you're a SaaS company. You know, you're in the hundreds of dollars. So that's something that I can leverage because that's my audience. So I, you know, that and also positioning ourselves intentionally as this premium brand. So it's not me, it's this brand that we've built that's trusted, that's been around for 10 years, I think is a core part of like building the framework for sponsorships and saying that this is what we can offer, but it is a premium price that you will be paying. And so, you know, like pricing is hard. And I don't know if we've gotten it right, but I think that we started off in a good place, which is like, because we've positioned ourselves in this way, let's go premium. Mm-hmm. And we know we have this audience, we know they engage with us, so let's charge a high price. You know, at 20,000, we charged, I think it was 1500, for an ad, for the top ad. We only did one ad at that time. Now we do two ads. We do a primary, which is the top ad, and then a secondary, which is lower down. And obviously the audience size has grown a lot more, so we can charge more.
Mm-hmm. Is it mostly, I mean, you said Burrow was inbound. These days, Is it mostly inbound or outbound for sponsors?
It's mostly inbound.
And mostly, wait, real quick, I bet a lot of the people sponsoring you already read the newsletter.
Well, so what tends to happen is when a company, when a developer tool company, a SaaS company, they raise a bunch of money, like they go from C to Series A or Series B, they'll build out their acquisition team. Their acquisition team will be like, okay, and they may not be engineers. They usually aren't. Some of them are. But
they ask their colleagues.
They'll ask their colleagues, what do you read? Mm-hmm. And so hopefully in that conversation, we are there. And if we are there, then we usually get, you know, some sort of inbound. And then we also just got endorsement from there's a blogger called The Pragmatic Engineer who is a huge Substack, and we recommended a lot of his content early on when he was a lot smaller. I mean, a brilliant writer, and he recommends us in his Substack because he does not take sponsorship, and that's also just given us a lot of inbound as well. Mm-hmm. So I think those two things have really helped us.
Do you have like a minimum issue commitment? Or last question about like the nuts and bolts of the advertising. Is there anything like that is like a forcing function for these relationships?
No, I actually don't. I mean, you can sponsor one issue if you want. And I do that intentionally because I want people to try it out. I want them to experience it. I also like the idea of, you know, if you're a seed stage company, you may have some budget. I like the idea of varying up my sponsorships so that, you know, it's a company that's growing. I like the idea that we can work with them, we can help them, I can learn what they're building. I think there's actually just value to that. So I don't do minimums for that, for those reasons.
Is monetization or advertising the only way you're monetized right now, or are there others?
No, it's all sponsorship. It's
Have you considered anything else, like a subscription product or like a paid subscription product?
I have. I'll never do it. I'll never do it because I think I'm very conscious of the fact that I am using other people's, well, not using, but I am promoting and endorsing other people's work. It doesn't feel right to me to charge for that. So I want it to be free. We have also thought about other opportunities around like coaching and leadership, mm-hmm. and diving into that. You know, I think increasing sponsorship, there are kind of two, you go wide or you go deep. And so I've thought of both of those. And then going deep is like, is there some sort of like a coaching, leadership or management course or platform where people can connect with coaches, etc., that could be valuable. So I've spent some time looking into that, as opportunities, but I haven't really committed to any of those.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. You were saying that the newsletter was at 20,000 in 2022, and I know that at the end of around the end when you, in 2017, after about 3 years when you left the VC, it was around 1,000. Now it's 40,000. So it took 3 years to go from 0 to 1,000, and then another 5 years to go from 1,000 to 20,000, and then only 3 years to go from 20 to 40,000. Tell me like what the growth story is. Why so long, 0 to 1, and then relatively not too uneven from, you know, that to 20 and 20 to 40?
Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, growing these letters is really hard.
True.
I mean, it's becoming easier. There are more tools, but that doesn't necessarily mean you can grow it the way that you want to grow it with the right audience. I think that's something that I've always been really mindful of. It's not just like, hey, let's increase our numbers, but let's increase our numbers with the right mm-hmm. audience, because that's effectively what our subscribers pay for. Oh, sorry, what our customers pay for, what the sponsors pay for. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, at the VC, there was like not a huge incentive to grow it. I like that people read it, and I like the fact that it was growing and grew organically.
It was just a corner of your job. It wasn't like
it was yeah, job at all. Like yeah. it was, you know, 10% of my time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we were on Product Hunt, like early Product Hunt as well, and that gave us like a really nice boost with a good quality audience, and then it just kind of. It was all organic growth, which I actually think is the best kind of growth sometimes, because I think when people find you on their own accord, they stay with a different intent in mind.
Oh, it's product market fit again.
It's product market fit.
It's usually much higher.
Yeah,
product market fit. Yeah.
Like they kind of haven't been like forced into it. And then, you know, I think that has held true probably up until 2022, which is like, okay, now this is a business. How do I think about growth? Mm-hmm. And now I'm, you know, and then the first thing to do was to be like, okay, can I monetize this? Can I sustain myself? Let me get that going. And then like, what budget do I have to reinvest in growth? Mm-hmm. Also, when you're living off a newsletter, there's not a lot of budget to invest in growth, especially in when you're living in Los Angeles or New York. Mm-hmm. But now we're at a point, I would say, where I can like meaningfully be like, okay, let's like put this budget aside. Let's run some experiments. So then that's what we're doing now. So we have two experiments running. We have Facebook ads, which is tried and tested way of growing newsletters. You know, the emphasis for me is always like, how do we do this meaningfully? Get the right people in, not just grow numbers for the sake of growing numbers. So I have a small team doing that. We have this other experiment, which is just me being weird, which is like, hey, let's publish this cartoon, which I think is kind of fun.
Two months in, right?
Weird. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, will people share it? Is this
Are you the one drawing it?
No. I wish I was. I wish I was. That's the hardest part, by the way, is, and it's not AI that's drawing it either. It's funny. I was talking to someone the other day who's a friend of mine who reads it, and he's like, I love them. He's like, what prompts are you using? What? And I'm like, no, these are hand-drawn.
Engineer brain.
Yeah, I know. I was like, no, these are hand-drawn. So now I write hand-drawn.
Yeah.
And, it's a quirky experiment for sure, but you've seen the newsletter. It's very text heavy. And while I that will always maintain, like, I've always liked the idea of breaking that up a little bit with a visual element. Mm-hmm. So I have the bit in the middle, but I was like, what if we have this like fun animated, like just, you know, ironic, like cerebral cartoon? It doesn't have to be funny. It could be thought provoking. It could be weird. It could be any of those things.
Yeah.
It's also inspired by like The Economist again, because they do that, I think, very effectively, and a couple of other newspapers. So I was like, why don't we just try it? And the hardest part of that was finding someone who understood the humor who could execute on it. It took some time to do.
Well, I'm reminded, somebody I interviewed recently, this guy Tom Fishburne, the Marketoonist, you've probably seen his work. He's been doing this in various ways for like 20 years, but he was like a marketing executive. He'd also always had a hobby of cartooning. Mm. And 15 years ago or so, he quit his full-time job. He had published one of his cartoons in the Wall Street Journal, and now it's what he does for a living. And he, you know, has the cartoons. He's like 400,000 people on LinkedIn, 100,000 people on his newsletter. But really he makes his money as like a consultant and like doing ad campaigns for companies where, you know, he's drawing cartoons for them. Or, you know, he'll go in and do like coaching on like humor and leadership, et cetera. But I'm very much reminded of this. And it's a play I really like that I think, I mean, when I was a kid, I would read, like, I grew up in Northern California. The San Francisco Chronicle was like the local big paper. And I remember like flipping around to look at the cartoons, go to the cartoon page, but also like the political cartoon. Like,
right.
I'm a big fan of. So when I saw this, I just think it's such a good thing to have. I'll read one. Maybe our producer, Tom, can put it on the screen here. It's from issue 624. So the cartoon's called Null Pointer. This is two panels. And it's this guy, probably a developer, you know, talking to these two black pillars, and he says, can you write me a binary search function in Python? And one of the pillars says, such a great question, you're an absolute genius. And the guy says, okay, that's a little much. And then one of the pillars says to the other, human didn't buy it. The other one says, world domination requires properly deceived underlings, recalibrate genius to moderately competent. And it's captioned sycophant AI. So yeah. I mean, just to say, maybe I didn't need to read the full thing out loud. Maybe Tom will edit that out and just put it on the screen. But I love it. It's so funny. I'd been wanting to ask if you'd before when I was prepping for this, if you'd done any other like formal experiments like this, but I couldn't really find any. So I'm just in trying to encourage you that it's awesome. Keep doing it. Have people been responding positively to it?
Yeah, it's funny. Like when I published it, I was expecting a huge response. Mm-hmm. And no one said anything. And I was like,
what's going on? I know the feeling.
And it's so just to give you some context, like when I transitioned off of my ESP to another ESP, I changed my fonts.
Mm.
And I probably got 30 people emailing being like, why did you change this font? Or I love the new font.
Yeah.
And so I was just anticipating, like, this feels like one of the biggest things that I've tried to experiment with, just because it's like this visual component in the newsletter, which I've never had before. So I was like expecting a lot of response, nothing. But then when slowly I started to have conversations with my friends who read the newsletter, they would mention it to me, which made me feel, okay, like there's something here. And what I like about it is that the newsletter is a very cerebral newsletter. Like there's a lot to read, right? You're like, you know, each article hopefully is like very thoughtful. Some of them are like very technical.
Even the TLDRs are pretty idea dense.
Yeah. They're very dense. So like, to your point, when you have a cartoon in a newsletter, like sometimes you just flip to it. Sometimes you're like, this is just the easiest thing for my brain to consume right now. And I want a dose of that. I want that little dopamine hit, that humor or that thought. So, and that's what I was trying to do, is just create that feeling for the subscriber. Because I think that it is something that complements the, and is different from what we have been offering them. But yeah, I mean, it's been fun hearing people talk about it. It's also been really fun doing that.
Yeah.
Cause I work with an awesome cartoonist who is an engineer, was an engineer at Google, at Twitter, and he's awesome. Very like clearly very talented. So we just have fun like riffing on these ideas. And I think also what's nice about them is that they kind of tap on the pulse, like those pillars you talked about, they are AIs. So like a lot of the thinking now is like, okay, there's so much conversation about AI, and clearly like some of us are very worried about it, some of us are very excited about it, but it's a very like emotional topic. But how do we just like make it a little fun just for now? Before we all lose our jobs to
Okay, so one other little change, maybe not so little, I don't know. I think the newsletter was initially called Project Uno, right? When did that change and why? Was that like the leaving
that was PC? Just like, we don't have a name for this right now, but we need to get this started, or we want to get it started. Let's call it Project Uno. And it was myself and my boss at the time, who was awesome, who kind of like at the VC, Nicola, who really advocated for it internally with the partners of the VC. So yeah, we called it Project Uno for a bit, and then we were like, let's give it a name. And we came up with Pointer.
That's funny. And then, okay, you've been using we to talk about working on the newsletter. And I know there is this cartoonist. Sounds like you have some people helping you with Facebook ads. It's maybe it's just you full time. I don't know. But who works? How many people work on the newsletter, and what are their functions?
I mean, I'm the full time person. I'm the we. Yeah. So we have I have some consultants that help me. I have a couple of people with the Facebook ads, someone with on the creative, someone helping me with just managing the strategy for and executing on it, and then we have the cartoonist, and then I have help with bookkeeping and accounts and those sorts of things, like back of office kind of stuff, which isn't insignificant. Like that's you know, so I it's a collective we.
How many hours a week do you spend working on it, do you think? And how much of that is split into like reading versus putting it together versus managing your time with all those consultants?
Yeah. I've tried to build this business in a way that I can do other things as well.
Yeah.
So this is the business that I run so that I can also run my own experiments.
Friday deploys,
yeah. So I probably spend about 10 to 20 hours. I would say probably 20 hours on it. I've gotten much quicker at writing the newsletter. I used to spend probably like 5-7 hours writing it. Now I can probably do it in like a couple, each issue. Every day I'll spend at least half an hour to an hour going through content, just finding articles, and then probably another like 4 to 5 hours like sifting through them.
That's not bad for what I'm assuming pays you a decent six-figure salary.
Yeah. The other thing that does take time is just sponsorship management and reporting and those sorts of things, invoicing, et cetera, but yeah.
One thing that you'd mentioned when we first spoke that I've been wanting to get into that I have very little context for is the internal tooling. You said that this is something that you've invested a good bit of time into, and that you think you probably have done in a way that very few other newsletter operators have.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know who's done.
Maybe I'm putting some words.
No, that's cool. The only reason I say this is one of the best things that I did. This is a side note, but I'll segue into answering or talking about the thing that you mentioned, which is, one of the best things that I did was that initially I did this in a big silo. Like, I can run this newsletter from anywhere in the world as long as I have an internet connection. There are pros and cons to that. but one of the best things that I did was I started to reach out to other newsletter creators because I was just curious to know what they like, how they operated their businesses. And I became friends with one creator, and we just took this approach of sharing everything with each other. Like our growth strategies, like how we thought about writing our content, like a lot of the things that I had a very specific point of view on.
Point, how many years into it was this?
This was not that long ago. This was probably 2023 that I did this. And that's when I was running, when it was like, okay, this is a business now, which is like I should learn how other people run similar businesses. Like that feels like a intelligent thing to do. So, and that was a great unlock to me because it was like, oh my God, like there are so many other things that I should be doing, so many other things that they could be doing. Mm. And so it was just like a lot of very rapid learning for both of us. But yeah, I mean, like going back to your question about internal tooling, like my newsletter is specifically like, you know, I share seven unsponsored links and two sponsored links. When I say sponsored, like, you know, the sponsorship, there are more than two sponsored links, but let's just say there are two sponsorships. I need to track their performance, but I also want to track the performance of all the content that I'm putting in there and understanding how my audience engages with them. That to me feels important because it's a way of measuring this, one way of measuring success of the newsletter. Like you have this content in front of you. Are you engaging with it? Is it interesting? What part of it is interesting to you? Why is it interesting to you? It's impossible to answer all those questions, but it's hard to also answer them with, I think, the way that a lot of current tooling is set up, like my ESP, for example. You know, yeah, I can get open rate for the newsletter. That's great. And yes, I can, if I can, you know, click on this tab, I can see how the links are performing. But it's very hard to be like, okay, this link performed with this number of clicks, unique clicks and total clicks. It was in the third position of the newsletter. How does that compare to all the other third positions of the newsletter in the last 6 months or year? And what kind of an article was that? And what was it about leadership? Was it about architecture? Was it about scaling? Was it about career advice? And how does that compare to those other articles? So those are questions that I was genuinely curious about. And being an engineer, I was like, well, I want to solve them. So I built a CRM. It automates now. So there's not a lot of work that goes into managing it or upkeeping it. But it pulls in all that information into a dashboard and allows me to track on a pretty granular basis, like how my newsletters are performing.
That's amazing.
And how each individual link is performing, how each link has a tag, like how that tag has performed over time, how it's trending. How that link that's in sixth position has performed against other links in sixth position, et cetera, et cetera. So that to me is really helpful. It's really valuable because I think there is some opacity. Like I'll send out this newsletter. Sometimes I don't get any responses and I'm like, okay, like, how does this do? Like, is this good? Do you like it? Do you not like it? But this is a way of trying to, like, get some feedback.
Mm. You don't have to go into full detail, but, like, how is that set up? That's fascinating.
I mean, so the hub of it is I use an Airtable. It's massive, but it basically has, like, every historical link that I've ever shared in Pointer. And it's plugged into my ESP using their API. I also have APIs for my invoicing system, which is QuickBooks. I have APIs from Streak, which is what I use for sponsorship management. That's all plugged in. Mm-hmm. And that gives me the ability to just have like one dashboard, one like entity that I can interact with that gives me that information. And the funny thing is, I think I make it sound bigger than it is. It wasn't that hard to build. Like setting it up was hard. But now, especially now with AI, like you can build a lot of this stuff pretty quickly.
Vibe code it.
And you can vibe code it, but you can also just like there are integrations. Yeah. There are probably hacks you can use. But just taking a more like scientific data like oriented approach to like to augment my curation is helpful. Yeah.
No, I really like that. Another feature I wanted to talk about briefly is the most popular from last issue link. I feel like this, when I see this, what it tells me is maybe it's like training readers how to read it. I don't know if better is the right word, but like helping them navigate the newsletter where it's like, oh, I didn't click that one, or like I saw that one, but I didn't read it. Like, I guess I should have. And maybe then it's influencing how they read this issue, how they read the next issue. It's like it's a way of showing them a glimpse of the mass of other readers. And then like, having them adopt the mindset of those other readers, which maybe I'm thinking too much into, you know, one link you put at the bottom of every issue, but I think it's pretty interesting from that perspective.
Yeah. And it's funny that also gets high engagement. So, which I always find interesting as well, because I'm like, okay, so you probably saw the last issue, you probably saw that link in it, but now you are choosing to engage with it probably for the first time, because if you engage with it last time, you're probably not going to click in on it again, unless you forgot. But I agree with you. I think there is some psychology to it as well, which is like, you know, we're accruing mass just in terms of our engagement. And this is one of the end products of that, which is like, this is what people are thinking about. This is what people are really interested in right now. Mm-hmm. I think it helps steer that ship and tell that story, which is maybe I should be thinking about this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Is there a sell by date on the content you aggregate, or is like, you know,
it's a good question.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's tricky because leadership and management for engineering is relatively new.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a lot newer than leadership and management of non-engineers, of typical business people. And it's a very specific, I would argue, a very specific way of managing and leading teams. Like, you know, it's not, I would say, traditional. So I think people are still figuring it out. I think it's a skill that's been around for 30 years, 20, 30 years, mm-hmm. really, since we've had tech companies. So I still think there's a lot of like evergreen content that is applicable, that I still like to reference. Cause I think sometimes we also, as people who manage and lead, we forget. And I think it's good to be reminded of like best practices and, you know, like mm-hmm. ways of doing those things, and complement that with like, okay, this is also like the new stuff. This is the more modern stuff. So I would say that there is a sell by date. Like I try and stay on, you know, like current. I also have competitors, like there are other aggregators out there. So, you know, we're all probably looking at the same stuff. So I want to be first to that stuff as much as I can, the stuff that I think is good. But I do like to complement it a little bit with like, okay, this was written in 1991, but it's still really interesting. It's still really relevant. It doesn't mean because it was written 30 years ago that it's not.
That makes your curation better to know like, oh, this is this one thing that is, you know, maybe older, but it adds context to the issue of the day, to the other things they're putting in. Regarding the competition, I think, you know, one of your moats is obviously your taste. We've talked about that from the very beginning of this conversation. Have these competitors like risen up just in recent years as the newsletter industry has gotten bigger, more competitive? Just a brief word on how you view the competitive landscape and your position in it.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there are a couple of newsletters that are huge now. There's TLDR, which has millions. I don't know if I view them as a direct competitor. I mean, they cover tech news at large. We cover, you know, we're very focused on engineering leadership management. That's not going to change. There are more niche newsletters that I think are really excellent that focus on our audience as well. You know, I'm all for it. I don't really see them as threats. I think the bigger threat for us is, how is technology going to change, and how's that going to impact this business? Like, I think that's the thing that's more pressing to me than other newsletters that also curate similar content.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Only one more thing. two-part question. What stops Pointer from being a business for another 10 years? I think part of the answer is probably in what you just said there. And then more near term, what are your goals for the next 12 months?
Yeah. So I think that the thing that could stop Pointer is just where the industry could head. I personally, as I learn more and build up a deeper understanding of where we are now, and I try and think logically of where we will go, I don't think it will happen. But that doesn't stop me from reading articles that say that, hey, engineering, like, we're not going to need engineers in the next few years. You know, or there's an article that says, hey, everyone's going to be an engineer in the next few years. Like who knows? You know, I think the answer is probably going to be somewhere in between. I do think things will change drastically. So I think it could be a threat that, you know, engineers will become obsolete and we'll have AIs building everything. That being said, one thing that I love about this industry of engineers is that there are people who do it for the love of the craft, and that's not going to stop with AI. I also don't think that AIs are going to all of a sudden start building really complex systems immediately. Like, there is a lot of human involvement that is necessarily to build safe, secure, thoughtful, elegant systems and architectures that vibe coding is not going to do right now. So I think we have a long way to go. So I don't really fear it as much as maybe other people, but it's still definitely in my brain.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah. I think we can end it there. Do you have any regrets doing your first podcast?
No, I think it's great. I love talking about it. I don't know. Yeah, I don't really talk about it as much, but I enjoy it. I think it's great.
Well, thank you for talking about it. This was fun.
Yeah, no, it was great. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, of course. Listener, I will see you next week.